Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Missing Mara Murray podcast. I am Tim, here today with Lance and Chloe. What's going on, everybody?
Hey, how's it going? We are in our brand new Worcester, Massachusetts studio.
Wormtown.
Wormtown. Still trying to figure out if anyone knows why it's called Wormtown. We have a couple of theories. We'll get to them later. But yeah, our first guest here is our old Crawl Space co-host or cohort, partner in crime, Chloe Cantor.
What's up, Chloe?
Not much. I'm excited to be here. It's very good to have a studio space, and it's good to see you too. So thanks for having me on.
Nice to see you too. And so today I think we'll be talking a little bit about the disappearance of Maura Murray TV show that just finished airing on Oxygen. And I feel like Chloe's take will be especially interesting because it's sort of from an outsider's perspective from the show. She's been in the online community and a part of us and this whole Missing Maura Murray community for years, but wasn't really a part of the TV show. So I just kind of curious how it read from an like someone who was outside the TV show.
And also as a... you know, we keep talking about the citizen detectives. You were kind of unintentionally brought into it when you helped us out with Brianna. So here you are witnessing the show, watching the show as part of that community with Maura Murray and the and with the citizen detective community. So, yeah, what's the overall feeling on it?
My opinion is probably different from the consensus. And I don't even think that it's fair to say that there is a consensus. I think that based on what people have been discussing on Facebook, on Reddit, on a number of different mediums, there's a lot of variance in what people thought about the show. I think, should I start with how I felt?
Sure, please.
Sure. I think that this show broke a lot of ground. I think that a lot of relationships between investigators and witnesses and family members were damaged, and Art and Maggie were able to sort of fix those. We could see the way that they were able to communicate with friends and family. I think that they were able to speak with people that have been silent for many years, and it was just really exciting coming from someone that's been following this case for years. And you can only fill in these spaces in your head, but actually seeing these people talking, like the interview with Kathleen, we haven't seen her sit down and talk to someone for a really long time, probably since the disappearance happened, and she was being interviewed by cameras in New Hampshire during the search. So having people like Kathleen sit down and talk for the first time was amazing to watch.
Yeah.
It was a pretty controversial moment there in the show as well. Did you find that it was as controversial as some people made it out to be?
I think when you say it's controversial, I think people felt that she was asked a lot of difficult questions, and they had someone in the other room analyzing her body language to see if she was lying when that really wasn't done for anyone else. And I get where people are coming from where they say that didn't seem like the most fair thing, but it I don't know if Maggie and Art really had the most say in what people came in or let me start that over. I don't think that those decisions were made by Maggie and Art about who was coming in and observing the interviews. I think that Oxygen maybe had more of a say than we like to see.
Yeah, well, they definitely did. It had nothing to do with Maggie and Art. They did not come up with that idea. They did not decide to get Evie in there to read her body language or anything like that.
But it also does speak a little bit to the actual investigation. People have to understand that this is about Maura. And for years, Kathleen has not said anything about, I mean, there's a direct connection there between the phone call that Maura has and says, my sister. And if you're going to interview Kathleen after so many years, as part of an investigative tactic, bringing somebody in to analyze body language, especially if it's a family member, seems like very reasonable to me. And I know that, you know, and Kathleen was such an amazing person to do the interview. And I know that she probably felt a little slighted by seeing that footage, but that's what's got to happen in order for something to shake loose in this case, because nothing has happened in so long.
Right.
Right. And, you know, I didn't even think about whether or not that was unfair until I saw the subsequent interviews with law enforcement, because I liked that they had someone come in analyzing body language, because it kind of kept that in my mind for subsequent interviews, noticing the way that the people were speaking and what they were doing with their body language. But I'm not a body language expert, so it would have been nice if they were able to apply that with everyone. And that's probably what people noticed. Like, why do they just have this person coming in for her and not for other people? First of all, they probably didn't have the resources to do that. It wasn't.
I don't think that would be allowed. I don't think that they could rent the door next to the room that they or the room next to where they interviewed Cecil Smith and Jeffrey Strelzin and John Monahan. I doubt they could rent out that room. It up with cameras.
But they did the next best thing, and they had Strelzin in there.
Yeah.
With them.
Well, you're joking.
No. If they needed, when I say they, I mean the investigation.
Yeah.
Him being in the room while they were questioning or while they're interviewing Smith and Jeff Williams, he needed to be in there. His position in law enforcement
is the senior assistant attorney general of New Hampshire, by the way, Jeffrey Strelzin, that we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. He should be there. It'd be weird if he wasn't there, you know? So all these moves that, you know, kind of raise eyebrows, like the body language person and him being in the room, it really is for like the investigation.
Sure.
Yeah. If I had that job, I would want to be there.
Yeah.
So watch those interviews.
I think it was to cover his own butt, probably. And not so much his butt, but everybody. Like, and to cover the creative editing or the potential of creative editing from a show.
Which happens.
So many reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wants to, is there information that's going to come out that I haven't heard yet? Why haven't I heard this yet? And then, yeah, well, I want to make sure that it's not cut in a, you know, they're not taking liberties the way they cut it.
Right.
And it's his job.
He runs the investigation as far as, like, the prosecution, I should say. So he really doesn't have anything to do with the day-to-day operations of the investigation that goes on now. Mm-hmm. They won't even probably report to him. Like, the cold case unit, they don't even talk to him unless they have a big break or something.
So are you saying he did it for screen time?
I'm saying that the communication between the attorney general's office and the cold case unit isn't necessarily there. They don't talk on a daily basis about the Maura Marty case, I'm sure.
Right. And I'm sure maybe you felt the same way, but once they finally started showing the law enforcement interviews, it kind of took my breath away, just seeing John Monahan, Cecil Smith, Jeff Williams, kind of, I think Jeff Williams wasn't until a subsequent episode, but these people, we haven't seen them talk, we haven't heard them talk since 2004, so I was overwhelmed by it, and I thought it was amazing that they were able to get that on camera.
Yeah, it really was. A lot of people talk about Cecil Smith, and they still think he's lying about this 001 versus 002 police vehicle. And so Cecil Smith famously said on the show that he was driving the SUV number 001 that fateful night, and people don't believe him, or some people don't.
It actually, like, something I've noticed on Facebook is it's overwhelming how many people still hold on to the police conspiracy theory and don't believe Cecil Smith and don't think that Maggie and Art did enough to probe further into whether or not there could have been there. A lot of things that people are saying is that there hasn't really been a way to confirm whether or not he was driving that car except for his own words, which is, I've been trying to find corroboration or something that contradicts it, and I haven't been able to.
Have you found anything that So you haven't found anything that conflicts that?
Well, I know for a very long time people were saying, presenting it like it was fact that he was driving sedan 002. But I haven't been able to find anything on paper that confirms that it was kind of all talk. And I don't know exactly where that talk originated. But that was, I feel, I don't know, maybe you guys disagree, but I feel like that was accepted as fact for a long time, to the point that when I saw that interview and he said that he was driving the Ford Explorer, I was shocked.
Yeah.
I did not see that coming. Maybe you guys did, or maybe other people did, but I really did not see that coming.
I only did because we had heard about it right before.
Right.
So we knew that was coming. But yeah, I mean, it's quite a stretch to think he's covering for Jeff Williams.
It would be an incredibly bold lie.
Yeah.
It would be such a bold lie. But
doesn't mean it's not a lie.
It doesn't mean it's not a lie. I think that the community would probably feel more confident if there was some way to confirm it. But so far, I haven't been able to find it. And maybe someone else can. I implore everyone to try.
So we can agree that Smith, during the course of his career, was a quality police officer, right?
I don't know.
I mean, he doesn't have anything on his record. He wasn't fired. He wasn't, like, discharged. He went out of his way to arrest the chief of police at the time, Jeff Williams.
Right.
He took over the position.
Right, he arrested him for a DUI.
So I'll rephrase the question. Yeah, he arrested him on charges of DUI. There's nothing saying that he's a bad person.
I think that Cecil arresting the chief probably leads credence to the fact that he didn't have a particular loyalty toward him. The fact that he actually arrested him, or perhaps he stopped his vehicle and then called for reinforcement and
sure.
then he was later arrested. I think if there was this loyalty there to the point where he would cover for him on national TV, he probably wouldn't have had him arrested. You would have just
right.
let him go.
So my point is, we're looking for this documentation of who was driving which vehicle. And the police and Smith, they all say that this vehicle was out of commission and I was driving this vehicle. And we're hearing it from people who have, as far as we know, a good record. How is that? Why are we at the point where we immediately distrust the chief of police who has a good record and say, well, he must be lying because he's nervous on camera?
I think, one, it's because, and I'm not trying to criticize anyone, but I think when people are holding on to a theory that makes a lot of sense for a really long time, at least makes sense to them, it's hard for them to let go, especially when they don't have further proof of what he's saying. I don't think he has a reason to lie here, but I think people might be accusing him of lying just because the narrative that's been out there all of this time was that it was a sedan. And I don't know where these I don't want to say rumors, but where the story originated from. But you know, we've been hearing that 001 was out of commission, that it couldn't have possibly been out there that night, that it wasn't working, that he was driving the sedan. And some people have said that he was definitely driving the sedan 002 because on the dispatch logs, it was identified as H2.
Inaccurately identified as H2.
Yes.
Right. And that was one of the questions that we've always had, which was, what does the H stand for? What does the H plus that number stand for? Because if the police are identified as a certain number in the dispatch log, why would they be identified by a letter and a number? And the letter obviously is Haverhill, right?
Yeah.
And 2 and 1 and 3, that is the rank. He was second in command behind Jeff Williams. So that he's being identified, and we have should we say Aaron? Because she has it
go
up.
Go for it.
Okay. And Aaron Larkin was actually face-to-face with the Haverhill Police Department and just point-blank asked them that question, and that's the answer.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering why we, you know, it's a police department of four back then. They're botching the investigation out of, you know, one breath. People say they're botching the investigation, and then the next breath is that it's this conspiracy. Of
right.
silence. Like, well, if they can't put together, like, if they can't hold together an investigation, how are they holding together a conspiracy for 13 years?
So, yeah. So what we're talking about, if Cecil Smith really was driving the sedan 002 and Jeff Williams was driving 001 that night, we're saying that Cecil Smith was loyal to him then not loyal to him several years later when he arrested him for a DUI, and now he's loyal to him again?
And covered up and maintained consistent silence throughout.
Yeah, it's confusing.
Right.
Also, I'd like to note that we have heard from Maggie and Art that the cold case unit does have proof that Cecil Smith was driving SUV 001. We are not allowed to say what proof that is, and they have not provided that to us. I demand the truth. But it's another one of those things that people will point to and say, well, they're lying to you guys. You know, they don't have proof of this.
I mean, how big of a conspiracy is it that now they've dragged Maggie and Art into it, too? And
potentially us.
Right. Yeah. I don't trust you guys anymore.
I tell you, it is a wonderful feeling when you finally let go of that narrative, when you've held on to a narrative for so long. Because, I mean, you and I have, Tim, when we've, talked about the case way back, you know, and it's like... I think it was this, and then you realize after some point, like, I'm forcing this right now, but once you open it up, it's like a weight off. Take this weight of the police conspiracy off and focus. Put that energy to something else.
I just think there are better persons of interest right now.
Exactly, you know?
I agree too.
And I think, like, it's interesting, and I want to track this down, and I want to see if there's documentation of Cecil Smith driving 002 that night. I think it's something to look into and everything, and I encourage people to look into it. But I just think there are better persons of interest.
I agree, and I would like to see this documentation of it, but. If Maggie and Art are saying the cold case unit confirmed it, that kind of closes the door for me for any speculation in that.
Right.
You know, I also feel like I said, like, I don't think that it's necessarily just this overwhelming inclination to assume that a police officer is lying, and more just that everything we've heard has been different. Like, no one until that show has said, oh, it was Cecil Smith was driving 001. Everyone was saying, no, he was definitely driving 002. So, I mean, is it productive to talk about how we got there, or?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I suppose it is, but it's probably its own episode.
Right. And it should be noted that Karen McNamara, witness A, who claimed to have seen the SUV at the scene, who drove by after leaving work, it's not debunked. She saw what she saw.
Right.
It just wasn't what it was made into years later.
You're talking about the Oxygen headline that says witness A debunked.
Yeah.
It isn't accurate at all.
It sounds like it verified what she saw.
Right.
It
absolutely did.
Yeah. She said that she saw the police SUV and everyone else was telling her that she didn't, but she was steadfast. No, that's what I saw. And it turns out it is what she saw.
Yep.
But because people were arguing against it for reasons that I can't quite track back to yet, it started creating all these ideas that maybe someone's lying, that there's some conspiracy out there.
So that's really what's debunked, is she saw what she saw, but what's debunked is person X's theory that it was Jeff Williams driving that vehicle. That's pretty much debunked. I mean, call me naive after all this time.
Naive.
Call me naive, but I take the word of Art and Maggie, Cecil Smith, New Hampshire State Police. I'm sorry. I take their word, and I'm that. And call me naive.
Until we have reason not naive. To.
Yeah, I think that's
I just don't
it.
Think we have any reason not to. At first, it seemed like it because there was a contradiction.
And there are people who have looked into this case longer than we have, you know, but most notably John Smith, who, you know, I think is still kind of thinking that this is a possibility, but he's looked into this a long time. So he's looked into this a lot longer than we have. So
sure.
Maybe we just haven't gotten to that point yet.
Well, maybe, I mean, we should maybe talk to him and try to figure out where, because I believe it was him that was saying that. I mean,
No, I'd love to.
It was him. He was really putting it out there that he was driving 002 and that Karen was told that that wasn't what she saw, and
right.
That I think, I don't know if he said it or if Karen said it, but someone said that she was told that the car was out of commission and that it wasn't possible. So I don't want to just discredit him and say he doesn't know, because he's been at it for 13 years. So
yeah.
I'd like to know, I guess, where that information is based on.
Okay.
Who told him that it was 002.
Right. Okay. And maybe we'll follow that up with John later in a subsequent episode. Thank you. let's quickly mention our new our live show that's coming up on Sunday, November 19th. At 6 p.m. in Somerville, Massachusetts. Take it away, Lance.
Somerville, Massachusetts, right in the heart of Davis Square. It's the Rockwell Theater. It's where we did our last live show for Crawl Space, where we had Lucian Greaves on, and we had the Cryptic Antiquarian on. It was a great turnout. Get your tickets now for this one, because we're pretty much ready to sell out. The capacity is right around 190, and we set aside tickets for certain individuals. So we're rapidly approaching the sellout point. Art and Maggie from the show will be there.
Mart,
as we call them now, just to save our vocal cords, and they will be there. These questions that we're addressing here, you can ask them person to person.
Oh, that'll be great. We'll do a Q&A at the end of, you know, our conversation with Matt, with Mart on the 19th.
I'll come with all my questions. Don't you worry.
Yeah. Perfect. So we are selling tickets through Brown Paper Ticket. The link to that will be in the show notes. It's on all of our social networking sites. So again, we are very close to selling out. And if you're considering going, I'd click on that link and reserve your spot.
Well, one other thing I want to talk about is the DNA. Chloe, right before we started rolling, you called your shot on this one, right? When the Natalie Holloway DNA situation was going on, you came by my place. We had a quick conversation, and you were like, "Oh, DNA is going to happen in this case too with the Maura Murray show." And I'm like, "I don't think so." And you nailed it. I didn't know at the time, but this DNA evidence. What do you think of this?
It was amazing to hear that they were able to get not one, but two people from that DNA profile, from the blood sample. I wish that they were able to figure out who. You know, they said that the definite profile they had was a male, and that they had a partial profile that they couldn't completely isolate from it, and they couldn't identify if it was male or female. And I believe Chuck West said that the chain of custody was too unclear and that they didn't have enough to be able to confirm that it was anyone, but the fact that they were able to gather something from that was truly amazing to me. Right. And I think it's amazing because you guys were the ones that cut those wood chips off, right?
We took pieces from the upstairs floor, and John Smith was the one that took the much larger samples from the downstairs closet underneath the A-frame stairs that go to, you know, up.
That's the closet that the cadaver dogs hit on back in the family PI run search back in 2006, I think it was. So they hit on that closet, which means that the dogs thought that there was a dead body in that closet at one point.
Right. These aren't like scent dogs that will pick up a dead raccoon.
Right. And I saw there was some discussion like, oh, what if it was menstrual blood?
Oh my God.
In the closet.
That annoyed me to no end.
A cadaver dog took a hit on it. Someone was probably dead in there. Not to mention the profile that they were able to get was a man, so I don't think that it was menstrual blood.
And they did get a female profile too.
There
was one man and one female is what we know. But we didn't know that they had a whole profile yet, and we still don't know if they could get one. But we believe that they could potentially get one.
Did I miss that on the show? I thought they said they weren't able to confirm whether or not it was male or female for the second one.
I can't remember if that happened on the show or if that was something we talked to Maggie and Art about afterwards.
Later.
I thought it was on the show that it was a woman.
Oh, yeah.
And they said it could be Maura.
Yeah, yeah, I remember she said that like, are you going to take this to the police because it could be Maura? And when they were discussing it at that point, it sounded like, you know, with the DNA profile, you have the numbers to compare it to with the origin profile. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, here we go. They can just look at Maura's sample that they definitely have and compare the numbers. But then they said they couldn't. So that kind of confused me a little bit. I don't know if you have any insight on that.
I don't really. But I think it is still being worked on. That is what we know. So there is some more information potentially to come out about this DNA.
Right. What we don't know is what we don't know. And that is they control it now. And when I say they, it's the people testing the DNA. And we should have faith that these people are going to do their due diligence and do a proper job with testing it. It's very small, and Art reiterated this several times. It's a very small sample. It's a very small sample. There's much larger samples that exist or hopefully exist in the house, in the place, in the closet that the cadaver dogs hit on. And
still,
as hopefully, unless some massive renovation happened, which would involve digging up the cement foundation. But just have faith that DNA is in the hands of the right people.
Yeah.
And I know that we're not privy to this, but I wonder if that bloody knife that Fred ended up submitting to the police that was given to him by, who was it, the brother?
Larry Moulton.
Larry Moulton. I wonder if it's the same blood, if they're able to compare the blood on that knife versus the blood on the wood.
I'd say if that was the case right now, you would have seen some, there probably would have been something along the lines of a search warrant or an arrest at this point.
Well, yeah. I have a theory about it, actually.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I think that Larry brought this knife to Fred knowing that it wasn't the murder weapon, but he wanted to get his brother investigated because he knew that he either did do something or potentially could have done something. But Larry, you know, we heard a lot about Larry, too, being kind of a weird guy, too.
Right, and why give it to Fred? Why not give it to the police? It's just, it's a little indirect. And you'd think that if, like you said, you don't think it was Moira's blood, but if it was, you'd think that there would be an arrest, or there would have been an arrest.
There should be something that's moving forward at this point.
So it probably wasn't.
Just, it would have been, yeah.
The Moulton brothers, they're filed under the section, super shady individuals that you can't put your finger on. We can't describe them. You know, you're like, I heard he's a weird character.
That was being nice.
And that, right. We've heard that these guys are monsters. We've also heard that they're very loving men.
Right. People have come forward on the Facebook discussion groups with screenshots of people testifying to Claude's character, saying that he was this loving man. But
yeah.
I think even the worst people can show different sides of themselves. Like, my favorite example is Ted Bundy saved, I don't know if it was hundreds or thousands of lives working for a suicide hotline. So there was a good side to him that helped people, but it doesn't take away from the fact that he had an evil side. So I think people can think awfully black and white about what people are capable of just because they do one good thing or one bad thing.
Or because you're this person's niece or nephew or something like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah, of course you're going to have a different perspective.
Right. And Ted Bundy probably got off by saving lives as much as he got off, you know, the power that he had.
Control.
And I'm not comparing Claude Moulton or Larry Moulton to Ted Bundy by any means.
Me neither. Sorry.
Sorry. It's a great story.
He does have... You know, I think this is confirmed that he has seven different kids from six women. So seven kids from six different women. That's Claude, the guy who lived in the A-frame house the time Moira went missing. So you're talking about a guy who has to be somewhat charismatic. I have no idea what he looks like. He might be, you know, he might be a really handsome guy. I don't know, but you know, he's got some game, I guess. I mean,
yeah,
he must
maybe
be somewhat charming. I mean, we hear psychopaths are charming, like Ted Bundy, for example, didn't have a problem getting a date.
No, I mean, he has a daughter out there, too. But
I'm not going to speak to the sexual prowess of...
Oh, no, I mean, I'm not even trying to either.
Even...
I'm just saying that he must have had some charisma.
But even if
he must have had some sort of attraction.
Yeah.
You'd think, but even if he didn't, I think most people can find someone out there who can say something good about you, even if you've done horrible things. There's going to be, you'd think, at least one person that can speak to something nice you did.
Not Lance.
I've gone a long
Not
time
Lance.
Without
yeah.
without some confirmation.
I'll speak for you. I got you. I'll vouch for you.
My thing about the DNA is that, like, how many other missing people were rumored to have been killed in that house? And Moira went missing a mile away. So I just think that's wild that she went missing a mile away. DNA was found in this house. To my knowledge, there's no other people that are supposed to be missing in that area. I really feel like there's a good chance that if they can get a profile, it is Moira.
Right. Well, and it sounds like just from the... I can't remember the man's name, but the person that was in charge of the fish and game searches.
Todd.
I think he said that out of the many, many people that he's looked for, only two people haven't been found, and one of them is Moira. So there's only so many people who have gone missing in that area.
Tells me she didn't go walk it off. And we just talked about Claude potentially having some charisma, and everyone says, well, who's what car is Moira going to get into? What stranger's car would Moira get into if she didn't say yes to Butch Atwood?
Would be someone that wasn't going to call the police, presumably, because that's, I think, a big fallacy. If she said no to Butch, why would she say yes to anyone else? Butch lived right down the road, said he was going to call the police, said he lived right down the road, and he was a bus driver, and I know they go through background checks. I wouldn't have gone into that bus with him, or I wouldn't have gone to his house.
I just think she changed her mind.
Right.
I think he approached her before she had abandoned her car. He came up on her car before she was done trying to start it again.
And it could have been before she made calls. Like, she could have said to him, like, I'm going to call AAA, and he misheard her. Or the circumstances definitely could have changed, and most likely did change after he left. And she was alone, and it was cold, and she needed a ride, probably. I think that the most likely scenario is that she would have accepted a ride from someone that didn't live right down the road, or didn't advertise that they lived right down the road, weren't going to call the police, and maybe looked less threatening.
Sure. And I think at this point we can safely say that there's a before Butch Atwood mindset. And an after Butch Atwood mindset.
Or I think it's more, the car. I would say before she tried to start her car, and then after she realized the car doesn't start.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a before and after. There's I can get the car out of here. I'm going to try to get the car out of here.
That's when Butch came.
I'm going to say no to this help because I just get hit in the face with a airbag and I'm hung up. So probably not thinking clearly. And then there's I'm not getting the car out of here. I need to come up with an alternative.
Right. Oh, and right in there is when she... What I think is when she went to the trunk and put the rag in the tailpipe,
right.
Went back into her car, tried to start it again, and then it didn't work. We know from the black box that there was no accident before that one. And we also know that she tried to start her car 7 times after that accident right there in the corner. So she was trying to get the car the hell out of there,
right.
And she must have put the rag in there herself. I don't think that's any mystery at this point. And then after she realized that didn't work, that's when she decided to take a little stroll down the road, and then I think she got into a car.
Everything, every detail that is documented says that.
I think you
do fill in a little bit on your own, everybody. You fill in a little bit on your own, but it really is just something that makes sense.
Right.
What the Westman saw, what the Marat saw, what Butch says he saw, and what he heard, and what was left. A car hung up in the snowbank, a car hung up on the side of the road with a rag in the tailpipe. Faith says she saw the activity by the trunk. We know that Fred told Moira if your car was sputtering to put the rag in the tailpipe to get by. We know the Marat said that they saw the reverse lights coming on, and we know that the black box says she tried to start the car several times. So that seems to me like somebody who thought that they were going to get some power out of their car by putting a rag in the tailpipe and getting out. And then she stopped trying and said, well, maybe I'm going to go up and accept this guy's offer to get warm in his house, use his phone. And if I use his phone, that will keep him off the phone from calling the police if I can call AAA.
Right.
Maybe she wasn't thinking that detailed, but she walked up in that direction. We know she did.
When we talk about things being debunked, the fact that we know that she didn't get into an accident before that based on the black box results debunks that was a big part of the conspiracy theory that she slid off the road not long before the 727 call in a different circumstance. So that's debunked because I think that fed into the police conspiracy theory, because in that scenario, the police were already aware of her and were looking for her, which people connected to the fact that the SUV passed witness A twice. Maybe they were kind of looking around for her, but if she didn't get into an accident before that, that kind of debunks that. And also that she's tried starting the car 7 times, that I see a picture of someone desperately trying to start the car and doing whatever they could to get away from there. She didn't want to leave the car there. And I think the rag in the tailpipe was not good advice. I think Fred would say that now too. But in that position, I think she was willing to try anything to get out of there.
Yeah.
You even dig deeper into the rag in the tailpipe thing and the car not running well. And the reason why Fred was with Moore that weekend was to look for a new car. I mean, all of these things have been staring us in the face for years, and too many people have said, no, these are lies. You look at it. He gave her bad advice to get by until they went to go buy a car,
yep.
Which he went up there to do.
Yep.
Yeah. So, like I said, we're talking about debunking things. I think that red herring is off the table.
I think the $4,000 and Fred stopping at 8 different ATMs potentially to get the $4,000 cash kind of makes people assume that he's lying about the rest of it, because it seems really weird on the surface. And we've talked about this a lot ad nauseum. But, you know, I just think that's him. I just think that's his personality.
Right. Also, something interesting, we were talking about Butch Atwood, and I don't want to take us too far back, but one of the things that Cecil Smith offered was that he didn't know Butch. But John Smith was actually able to unearth, I don't know who took the notes, but maybe it was the McDonald's that were interviewing.
Yeah, I believe it was Bob's sister, I thought it was.
Sister or wife, I'm not sure, but he actually posted the typed up notes where Butch said that he and Cecil Smith were friends. And that they were old friends for a long time. And Cecil Smith offered in the most recent interview that he didn't know Butch. So that's a little odd.
Well, Butch has also said that he was a former police officer, which he wasn't. So maybe he has a thing about being in with the cops or whatever. Or maybe he really does have, you know, some friends and he's like a friend of a friend of Cecil's or something like that.
Maybe Butch just has a compulsive lying attitude because was she leaning against the car? Was she out of the car? Was she inside the car? Story. Was her hair up? Was her hair down? It's like all these little details and the inconsistencies with the lie detector tests. Maybe he just has like a slight problem with not being able to tell the truth. Maybe he feels this compulsion that he has to elaborate or lie about something.
And that some people are like that, and people have openly accused him of that. I believe John Healy straight up said that he was a pathological liar, and like you said he was a police officer and he wasn't. That's a lie that he has been caught in, and he's been inconsistent with his accounts about his conversation with Maura. So if it's just his personality and he's just a pathological liar, I suppose it's not productive to go too deep in how those lies function, because they probably just function to entertain him because he's bored. But when you're talking about one person saying they're not friends, they never met, and the other one saying that they are, one of them is not telling the truth.
Yeah, it's probably Butch.
It's probably Butch, right?
Probably. I don't know for a fact.
I don't know for a fact either, but it's probably Butch.
Because
but if
we
it's
know
not,
he lied before.
Right. But if it's not, we have to think about why. And if they didn't know each other, it's an interesting but not an unprecedented choice to enlist his help into searching.
What else, Chloe? What else from the TV show were big moments or Lance? What was another big moment that you think we should talk about here? Like a takeaway?
The last episode, I think, received the most criticism from listeners, just because they gave a lot of time to the psychic, and that didn't really take them anywhere. It wasn't really productive, and I think people were foreseeing a storyline following a suspect, because I think that was kind of teased, but that didn't end up happening either. And I'm sure it was for legal reasons, but that, I don't know. I think when people are really being critical of the show, that's the episode that I noticed the most.
Yeah,
people.
Well, we can follow up on the persons of interest, because it is a legal thing with Oxygen, you know, but it's not really with us. And as far as the medium Alison Dubois goes, this was not Maggie or Art's or Mart's decision to bring her in. She has worked with Bravo on the Real Housewives program, and Bravo and Oxygen are kind of like sister companies. So it seemed like that was their decision, the network's decision. So
I think that's a big misunderstanding with people criticizing the show, is assuming that Maggie and Art called all the shots and that all of the choices were theirs. And like you were just saying, it wasn't. They had a whole network that they had to work with.
Yeah.
And lawyers. Tons of lawyers.
Right. If only they had all the freedom they could, I think it would have been different, but...
Right. And we do know that there was a lot that went on behind the scenes as far as, you know, the interviews that took place. You know, you only got to see like 30 seconds here and 15 seconds there. And a TV show has to do some sort of teasing for when they're, you know, they need to get people to watch. And I've said this to the point where it's probably getting annoying now. But
I don't even know what you're going to say, but it's already annoying.
I'm annoyed.
The sum of the parts of the show aren't as important as the whole of the show. And the whole of the show is really it's getting more people to talk about it, and these conversations are happening a lot faster now, and they're going away a lot faster. Mm-hmm. Like, what about this? What about red herring X? And then that's gone, because it just feels like the conversation isn't like dwelling in its own pool of like gesticulation. You know,
there's evolved.
It's evolved.
The conversations have evolved. We're not dealing with the same issues we were talking about online 2 months ago.
I mean, and just for we can list many examples right now, but I think notably talking to Erin, her classmate, about the pregnancy, the assignment about maternal medicine, and
right.
I think the word is teratogens or tetrogens, things that can impact a fetus when you're pregnant. The fact that that was something that was discussed, that maybe there was an assignment and we knew that she was in a maternal nursing class, but having that confirmed by a classmate who received her portion of the assignment on February 9th, that was pretty amazing. And just there were a lot of things like that where these red herrings were just, and people don't like the word, but debunked.
Right. And that kind of takes away the idea, or at least like what some people would point to as evidence or circumstantial evidence that Maura was pregnant.
Right.
So now there's not even circumstantial evidence you can point to her being pregnant. So
that was the only one.
It's okay, it's your opinion that you think Maura was pregnant, but it's not based on anything now.
Right. So that conversation's evolved. Yeah, that's
right. It's evolved,
and that's how fast it goes.
Right.
It, you know, you say it, and then you say, "Well, this person, it's backed up."
Right.
You know, there's corroboration there. It's totally backed up, and people don't like the psychic. I personally didn't like the psychic angle. But that doesn't matter, because that doesn't it didn't impact the case in a negative way.
No.
The show, they need to put a psychic on because the psychics, some people like psychics, so people watched, and those people might have got something else out of the show, so that's what the impact is.
Or given people different avenues to think. Right. I don't know. I just think the show was really important because it closed a lot of rabbit holes that we were unwittingly wasting our time on. We were jumping into them because it was our due diligence, because we needed to figure it out, and they helped us. They helped all of the community with closing these holes, I think.
Yeah, so. I think so.
Like when you saw those dogs, when you saw that dog sit down right at the corner of Bradley Hill and Route 112, there's no question in my mind after that. Like,
right.
She got in a car.
We hear, we've heard that the dog stopped 100 yards up the road. I remember when you asked those questions to law enforcement, they couldn't really confirm it. They wouldn't really directly answer the question. And there's been criticism in the past that it was too long and all of these things. But I really think that the show showed us how the scent trail works and the science behind it, and just giving us that actual demonstration for me. And we also learned that the dog did it not once but twice. I hadn't heard that before the show.
Right. Two different dogs, I believe.
Two different dogs. So that's a measure of reliability there, that they did it twice.
Yeah. Okay, so last topic here today in this episode that we want to touch upon is a new theory that's been put out there by James Renner, and it involves some allegations against Bill Rausch. If you haven't heard this stuff yet, you can check out James's blog. It's interesting. I don't know where we're going with it. I don't know what the heck's going on with it, but it seems like when something happens in the world, the Maura Murray case sort of mirrors it. So there's all these people coming out about these sexual accusations about Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey and all these things in the real world going on. And then what's going on in the Maura Murray case is these allegations against Bill. And there's people coming out talking about Bill not being a good guy and saying some weird stuff. What do you think of this stuff?
The stories are disturbing, and I find the people that were telling them to be credible. If you guys listen to the recorded accounts, it sounds like Bill had a pattern of being predatory and just not respectful to the point of assaulting women.
Allegedly.
We hear stories. I believe we have heard things in the past implying that he could have been physical with Maura, allegedly. And I think that came from Hossein Baghdadi through James Renner, that James got the impression from Hoss that Bill could get physical with Maura. We're hearing a lot of different stories. I think it proves that, I don't think it proves anything yet. I think it implies that Bill is not a very good guy. I don't think it gives us any proof about his involvement with Maura. We know that he wasn't there.
Yeah.
I think she had a boyfriend that wasn't very good, but he wasn't there.
Right, he wasn't in New Hampshire when Maura went missing.
When Maura went missing, he wasn't there, and he was there in the following days, and I think some people have been theorizing that maybe he found her. You know, it is documented that he was in New Hampshire after she went missing, and if she was still alive then, that maybe he could have found her and was so enraged that he killed her. But when you think about all of the things that he had to do to get away with that, I just don't think it makes a lot of sense.
Lance?
It's really hard to comment on Bill in the Maura Murray case and Bill in his life that's this alleged sexual predator that we're hearing through James Renner and his blog. Bill is doing what he should be doing by keeping quiet. He probably has lawyers saying, the second you open your mouth, you're opening up a whole can of worms, and you don't say a word. You don't comment on this. And that's just what is being done by probably his smart lawyers. As far as taking that, and if these allegations are true, I mean, he's a sexual monster. If these allegations are true, and it would appear that he's escalating by pushing people downstairs.
Why would you say sexual monster?
Because these are sexual.
There was only
abuse.
One story that involved. I guess the first story involved sort of an attempted sexual.
In the office.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah. It all seems very sexually based anyway.
The story
with the choking.
She was pushed over a table and he kept pushing her back down. In this story, that's what she said. It's pretty sexual.
Yeah.
And then pushing, like, allegedly pushing someone, the same person, down the stairs in a subway.
That story's terrifying. I lived in D.C.
The story's terrifying.
And those escalators are so long. Like, he could have killed her if that's true.
If that's true, and that's a separate investigation,
right?
And to put that in with more. Okay, so maybe he did this. We don't know. What happened 13 and a half years ago with Maura? You have to look at it as a separate thing. You have to look at it as column A and column B.
Yeah.
Until something is proven.
Right.
If column A is Maura and column B is these allegations, you can't put them together until you have a connection.
Right.
Until you have a proof of column B. You can't put them together. And with the phone records, if he tracked her down, he would have to be making attempts to call her. I know there's a question about this 3-minute call that was on the phone records, and it's presented as a long voicemail. Right before that call is a 1-minute call. And let's say that this is a boyfriend who is in his early 20s and his girlfriend's missing. And what was it, 6 days later, 4 days later, 6 days later, I think it was on the 15th, he made this call. Last-ditch effort, calls her phone. The call right before that is 1 minute. The call right after that is 3 minutes. So he calls, gets voicemail, hangs up. When you're calling somebody on the phone record, whenever it picks up, the phone record will register a minute. That's how they charge those phones. You paid, you know, you had so many minutes on your plan, so it registers a minute. So no matter what, it's a minute.
Even if you hung up on the person, they answered, it would register as a minute.
Even if voicemail picks up, it registers as a minute. So you have to imagine you call somebody, voicemail picks up. Voicemail's what, 10, 15, 20 seconds of leave a message at the beep, and then he leaves his message. His message could have been 45 seconds, which seems reasonable if you're the boyfriend looking for your girlfriend.
I feel like I would leave many voicemails.
Yeah, right. I feel like it would be a lot longer than that, actually.
It could have been. I'm giving the benefit of the doubt here and saying even if it went to 2 minutes and 15 seconds, including the intro, leave your message at the beep, it still registers as 3 minutes.
Right.
It's not somebody who leaves this long-ass voicemail for 10 minutes. It actually just sounds like someone left a voicemail.
We're hearing a lot of disturbing stories, and I think right now it's just a distraction. Like, one of the anecdotes we heard was that Bill would go on TV and played the part of the sad boyfriend to pick up women. That's horrible. When I read that, I was disgusted. We don't even know if it's true. But if it is, it's disgusting. But it's still not proof that he did anything. It's still not connecting him to anything. I just think it's distraction.
Yeah, so we do have to take these incidents separately and kind of keep them separate as long as we can and see where it goes. But it is interesting. I mean, if nothing else, the allegations are very interesting.
Yeah. The most frustrating thing about it is if you put everything of the allegations into column B and you're looking for proof in column B, you're probably never going to find proof.
Right.
Bill is not coming out and admitting anything. Bill's not coming out and denying anything because his lawyers are saying the second you open your mouth, it's over. You look guilty.
Well, they need, you know, Maura's body, if that's the case. If Bill killed her, Maura's body will tell the story.
Right, because that... Good. That's column A.
Yeah.
Then you've proven something in column A, and if it's proof towards Bill, then column B is more believable.
And like in column A, we have, you know, when someone meets foul play, it's usually by someone they know. We have a potentially established history of being controlling, being violent. We have both parties potentially cheating on each other. There's a lot of there are circumstantial things in column A, but what we have missing and what is glaring is that he wasn't there. During the time of the crash, he was in a different state miles away. Thousands of miles away.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you guys for chatting today, and thank you very much out there for listening to this episode. We will be back with more soon. Follow us on Twitter at MauraMariDoc, and check out Crawlspace, too. Check us out on Twitter at CrawlspacePod. Thank you very much.